and for humanity are incredibly emotional.
Well, I understand that, but I was listening to Michael Savage, and some woman called in because he was talking about this. I think it was maybe 4 or 5 days ago, and some woman called in, basically coming out that the U.S. should bomb Syria. And I was surprised. He finally crossed over the line where he said, you know, I'm so tired of AIPAC trying to dictate U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East that we've given Israel billions of dollars. I mean, I was kind of surprised he finally crossed the line.
Right. Well.
Did he finally? I mean, he's alluded to it a few times, but this time he finally got. I don't know what got him going, but that we have no real national interest in bombing Syria. But they're no threat to this country militarily.
I mean, Obama put the red line down, and Michael Wiener, he did it.
But isn't that what all of them are saying? All of your right-wing type folks are saying that we shouldn't be doing this. I mean, that they're not in favor of it.
Well, I can't listen to Rush Limbaugh for more than for more than 30 seconds.
Well, I listen to him a little bit each week. I can't stomach Sean Hannity much, but it seems to me like where they've been on this stuff is really keying in on the whole. It's annoying to me because it's almost like making a game out of it, or like not almost, but it's purely like it's a game, because it's like, you know, he said this red line statement.
Mm-hmm.
They made all kinds of hay about, you know, that, and now it's as if, you know, what are you going to do now? I mean, they've done it. They've done it. You said it was a red line. You're destroying American credibility and making all these arguments that you're hurting America by saying you're going to do something, and now he's done it. You got to do something. That kind of makes you have to have some sort of military response, right? And then to be upset that he's talking about a military response kind of weakens your argument. I'm not in favor of a military response. I'm just saying.
Well, you know, there's a narrow, you know, going back to historical time, there's a narrow line here that this administration is walking, and that is, we talk about the day in infamy when Japan attacked, you know, Pearl Harbor, but supposedly if the Japanese had given a warning first, it necessarily wouldn't have been a day of infamy. So in other words, militarily, I would think that, you wouldn't telegraph your intention to attack. You would just attack. But then, you know, that would be, we'd be blamed for the same thing that the Japanese were when they attacked Pearl Harbor.
What do you mean? If we had.
Well, what I'm saying is, It's sort of like, what's the point of all this? Because, you know, the Assad regime, or what have you, you know, government has had 2 or 3 weeks now to move all their equipment around. So there's no surprise element to this. There's no real surprise element. We're telegraphing to the Assad regime that we're going, you know, if they get the green light congressional vote, then, you know, we're telegraphing to them that, you know, we're going to attack them soon.
But we were only going to punk them in the first place. I mean, Obama said specifically this would be a shot across the bow.
Right. They can't move their airports. You know what I mean?
Well,
they're
talking about
chemical weapons and stuff like that.
Well, but as far as what Obama's going to do, I mean, when he made the statement that they would be able to do what they want to do next week, next month. We could do what we want to do anytime we want to, because we own you, is basically what he's saying to Syria. We own you. We can. Well, we've got the dominant military and capabilities to go in and, again, decimate their command structure and their business, their headquarters, their facilities to where...
It's 2 o'clock, after 2 o'clock, right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City.
But to be able to just, like, decimate their capability, we're able to do that. But you still come back to the question of what's our interest? Why are we looking at doing this? What would be served? I mean,
well, I can say, you know, you Jake can look this up. I don't have the article, but supposedly there's two gas pipes involved in this somewhere or other, where one benefits Israel and one doesn't.
Well, they want to
financially. One benefits Israel and the other one doesn't.
Under the Mediterranean Sea, they'd like to have some natural gas pipelines that go all the way to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a push to have natural... I mean, the ultimate, you know, prize is, of course, to move oil through the Mediterranean, through the Gulf of... Suez Canal onto China. And, of course, I mean, Israel wants a piece of the action.
Israel, I think, is a super paranoid country, you know, and you could say that they have a reason to be paranoid, but
right.
And I guess, you know, the idea might be that chemical stockpiles might be looted in Syria and funneled back into terrorist groups that might launch some kind of a an attack on the, you know, the public in Israel. I mean, I suppose that's being fed to the Israeli public.
Well, no, you saw there were pictures of them just a couple days ago lining up to get brand new gas masks all over again. And, I mean, of course Israel is paranoid. It's, what, 7 miles thick in one area?
No, that's true.
I mean, and it's not like it's been the most diplomatic neighbor of its countries either. I mean, you know, so there's a lot of reasons for Israel to be super paranoid. But everyone wants a piece of that action over there. You know, the interesting thing is that, you know, Saudi Arabia and Israel have mutual interests here in regards to the Syrian conflict. They both would like to see a very similar outcome. And isn't that bizarre?
Well, I think this thing could be defanged, at least long-term, if the United States... Of course, if the United States government, whatever government, said, you know, we're going to have a Manhattan-style project to, go pull guns on solar, you know, so, you know, increasing solar efficiency.
Russ, we don't even need to do that. We can continue to use fossil fuels. We could just use our own fossil fuels. But what we would have to do to make that feasible as far as our own national security or national economic or whatever interest is to take our fossil fuels out of the globalized market and to take our dollar out of the globalized market.
Right?
I mean, that's what needs to happen. That's the situation here, because they say there's an equivalency of 1 trillion, you know, barrels of oil, you know, the equivalent energy in natural gas in America, not to mention all the oil that's here, too. I mean, so we don't need this. It's just the system that's been set up because, you know, when you start controlling stuff, you know, the idea is when you get power, you want more power, and you can't stop. That's where we're at.
No, that's true. But, you know, the other side of this argument might be that We're reaching a point in human history when we have to have a one-world government.
Heyo.
So on that happy note, I'm gonna go back to the one-world government here.
Very well. Later. All right, 9 minutes after the hour of 2, We're going to take a little break here and play some spots, and we'll be back with you in a little bit right here on the Paragon Radio Program, 816-931-5534, 931-KKFI.
When it comes to domestic violence, do we hide behind a mask? Domestic violence is everybody's business. The Domestic Violence Awareness Conference takes place on Saturday, September 28th from 11:30 to 3:30 at the Urban League, located at 1710 Paseo. Guest speakers will be sharing their personal experiences, and a light lunch will be provided. More information can be found at www.eventswithapurposekc.com. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Support for KKFI provided by Fan Addict, presenting the 9th Annual Crossroads Music Fest, Saturday, September 14th. 25 bands on 6 stages, featuring Hearts of Darkness, My Brothers and Sisters, The Grizzly Hand, Starhaven Rounders, Dead Voices, Cherokee Rock Rifle, She's a Keeper, Diverse, Lee Langston, Not a Planet, Eric Vake, Amy Farron, Mikal Shapiro, Sunu, Mr. Marcos V7, and many more. Tickets at cmfkc.com.
Shovel by my dragonfly. There was snot in Spain, but all the same, you know it's a groovy night, and the wind's just right there.
Now we're back.
Now we're back. Good morning, Kansas City. This is the Paragon Radio Show. Ben has left the building. It's me, Michael T, and Jake.
On the ones and twos.
On the ones and twos and the threes and fours, waiting for you. Give us a call if you want to join the conversation. Such as it is, 816-931-5534. That's 931-KKFI. And I was just reading through some of these, essays, editorials, dissecting and analyzing the whole Syrian thing. And we've been talking about Syria all night. But it's just amazing to me how... It just keeps coming back to, you know, this should have been a done deal. Steve Rose ultimately ends up with, hopefully, Kevin Yoder and the members of Congress will step up to the plate since Obama wasn't man enough.
Right.
Harry Truman would have said, buck stops here and done what he had to do.
Well, and they had... you know, something to work with. I'm not doubting something's happened in Syria, but like we've mentioned and hinted at, what exactly that is, it's almost impossible to tell. And who did what and why. You know, the motivations are so murky to me. Is it religious? Is it economic? Is it an insurgency? You know, are they rebels? Are they mercenaries? It's a region of the world that's been in conflict my whole,
life.
Yeah, my
all
whole
of
life.
It.
As far back as I can remember, there's this conflict in that region.
And when you go back to this particular dictatorship is based on, this is a, all practical purposes, right? A kingship, right? Because it's like the father, son, pass it down kind of thing. And then these folks are still in power, right? So there is a sizable amount of that country that is in favor of him. I mean, if it was like some of these other dictators that we've seen in the quote-unquote Arab Spring, you know what I mean? The dictatorships have fallen by the wayside because they just didn't have the popular support.
Right.
You know.
And Damascus, isn't it one of the longest running cities still on Earth? And it was in the same spot, same name, same general way of life. So it's hard to believe that they have free and fair elections, the people running that.
Right, the machines have had a long time to get themselves locked in place. Well, and it definitely says something that there are people who want some sort of change. But when you get to that point that people want change, then like you say, you've got all these different people who are offering change, whether it be along religious lines, economic lines, whatever. And that's where, again, I come to what role do I have in their struggle? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not, I go back to, and I can't remember if I was talking about this on air last week. I think I was talking with you a little bit about this after the show. Just the American Revolution was like 8 years long.
Right.
And there wasn't, there wasn't some immediate, France will do the fighting for us. France will come in and do all of this for us. Because if that had happened, then we would not have been, independent states, we would have become French vassals. You know what I mean?
Like Louisiana.
Right. I mean, you know what I'm saying? We would have been saying, okay, we'll trade one for the other instead of we want
Right. We don't want to be ruled by the British. We want to be ruled by the French.
And it takes a long time to get a boot off your neck. So, I mean, I'm not, again, in favor of this Assad regime. I'm not in favor of any kind of setup where, you know, where you have that kind of total power, you know, top-down power. But in order to assert the power of the people have to be free to do that.
Right, and informed at the very least. You know, it's you know, and that's the other difficult perspective is what, you know, the actual individuals that are being displaced, you know, their point of view, their frame of reference,
right,
you know, what they're actually being given as far as information versus propaganda. It's a multi-layered and very difficult onion to deal with.
But right, because if indeed, and again, we don't know, but if indeed this was some sort of false flag deal, right, where not necessarily there was like the United States, I mean, being intimated some stories that hinted that, but let's just say you have rebels that when they were in control of some of these different townships and things that they acquired the chemical weapons and then decided to use them in a, you know, in a play to get America or the world to intervene, you know, in a play to get some superior firepower over Assad, right? If they did that, like you said about informed, right? If the average Syrian knew that it was not Assad that did this, but it was some other rebel force, then that would definitely, I would think, affect how they feel about that particular wing of the rebellion, right? Because, right, again, you got these different factions fighting for their different things. I heard somebody trying to enumerate it, and they had it down to like six different battle fronts that you got going on there, because you've got the Syrian, or you've got the different religious and economic forces at play. You've got Kurds that are always trying to figure something out in that whole Turkish Iranian, you know what I mean, in that, or right, Iraqi area.
Well, and I think this gets overlooked a lot also. If you look at a map of the whole area, one, it's not geographically that big of an area,
right,
between Israel, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Iraq. You know, obviously Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Turkey are larger countries. But this is geographically interesting because it's a hub between Africa, India, Asia, and Europe.
Right.
Culturally, it's a bizarre hub that, you know, north of Turkey is pretty much Anglo and Western. You know, south of Israel is Africa and all its, you know, variety. Then you have the Middle East, obviously, right there. And then you move into Hindi and Indian territory on up into the Mongols, and then it just seems like it's kind of a meeting place for diametrically opposed cultures and economies and religions, and that it's you know, geographically pertinent to the issue, all of the shenanigans aside, that if you're, you know, diabolical goals include things like world domination, there are hubs like the Middle East, you know, that you're going to have to cross to get physically to one location or another, or at least conquer and get going economically. Because, you know, just imagine the amount of confusion, you know, just in Europe, for example, with, you know, electrical outlets or types of currency used or languages spoken. I mean, you can go you know, within a few miles and be reading left to right or right to left.
Right.
The characters being radically different, but it's, you know, it's deep and long rooted, and apparently because of its physical location on the planet, you know, with the Mediterranean Sea, the Black Sea, the Caspian Sea, the Arabian Sea, you know, the Gulf of Aden, all that stuff is just right there. And not to mention they went and put it all on top of all that delicious oil.
Right.
You know, if the geopolitics, most of this seems like symptoms of the schizophrenic nature of the state itself and not necessarily, you know, right versus wrong. A bunch of different squirrels trying to get a bunch of different nuts. And so, yeah, the answer would have to be something different other than the state. You know, if breakthroughs in free energy, proliferation of information itself, you know, like I was saying, who knows what the actual human beings displaced in dealing with this nonsense. What are they told about Assad or the rebels?
Right.
You know, I think the people themselves, if they were, you know, given access to one or all of those, energy independence, you know, and we talk a lot here about energy independence. Think about all the people that want us free of their, of quote unquote, their oil. You know, all the average day Joes and Janes of the Middle East that are probably just as sick to death of the fighting as we are, if not more, since they're,
it's in their backyard.
Direct line of fire. You know, how much they want us to be independent of the oil itself. And imagine the motivation there if, you know, some of the free energy devices, technology, science lines of thinking, if that were to proliferate through that region, what, you know, just good old-fashioned gumption and ingenuity and what do they say, desperation leads most inspiration. You know, these people get sick enough of it. And apparently there's lots of sun and wind there, so solar and, you know, wind turbines, just of the listed available technologies. God, don't you think they want to be free of the oil themselves and not have it be some international hub for backing different currencies globally?
Right.
You know, and I was kind of kidding earlier when, was it Russ asking about how many world, no, it's Ben.
Yeah, how many world wars?
The first one Wikipedia lists was, Syria, the forces of Syria basically versus the forces of Egypt. That 1200 something BC, I think it said, I've already X'd
yeah,
out.
The Assyrian.
Yeah, but that region of the world has been kind of in the midst of turmoil since, you know, as best we can tell.
Human history.
Yeah, 4,000 years in a row. Yeah, give them the internet, some high-quality free time, a few universities, computers, and, you know, a different approach other than death, and murder and war, which apparently hasn't worked. All of their holy books haven't worked. You know, maybe a new approach needs to be tried. Yeah, it's amazing how little of an area that actually is when you zoom out.
Right. I mean, and like you said, it's been the source of so much for so long. I mean, when you start talking back to Crusades and you know, it predates the oil for sure.
Absolutely. And it's, again, I think geographically, because you have such diversity from Europe to Central Africa and from India to, you know, the Mediterranean, that just physically being located in that spot, it's crossroads for, you know, trade of all sorts. The spice routes run through there, and, you know, all your famous pilgrimages run through there. I think it's interesting, in the geography itself.
Like the world has a
as the
need
crossroads
to go there.
It's
yeah,
an ancient crossroads district. It just, you know, I guess when you have enough diversity and extremes on either ends all meeting in one spot, and it's kind of a shame too, because you know it's probably, I've never been there, but pictographically a very beautiful
oh, yeah.
part of the world.
Well, I had some friends that were Syrian back in the I guess it would have been 2000, early 2001 that I last spoke with them, and we would talk about that stuff and just how beautiful it was there and how friendly the people were and how they didn't want, you know, involvement in all of the geopolitics.
Right, because we hear, you know, plenty from Assad and, you know, Muammar Gaddafi and Benjamin Netanyahu and all the, you know, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the last president, you know, from Iran. We hear plenty from them, but it's rare to get like a man on the street type feel for, you know, what the Syrians think versus the Lebanese versus the Jordanians versus the Israelis, because you could, you know, get to a point here around Erbidi, would be a phonetical pronunciation of it, that you could play hopscotch and be in any one of those locations.
All right. Well, and then too, just how so much of that was carved up and created after hundreds of years of colonization.
Yeah.
Whether it's from, you know, the British to, you know, the various European powers, and then you got the Ottoman Empire, which I don't even pretend to know the type of politics that constructed that thing.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Because that was such a large and formidable thing for its own period that kept it kind of out of Western. I mean, it's just not really in Western history.
No. And, well, and it's, you know, obviously covered, but, you know, Turkey and Saudi Arabia kind of are the bread on this Middle East sandwich. And typically, although there's, you know, plenty of news and information to be gathered about those two places, you know, they're typically not the focus, yet so much of the power in that situation resides in Turkey and or Saudi Arabia. You know, that those two puzzle pieces are obviously big ones, but rarely addressed in the same light of what's going on. And, yeah, all the way back to the Ottomans and Persian Empire, and man, it's a tough nut to crack. You know, there's even schools of thought, you know, physiologically, if we're even designed to, you know, if we're even capable of understanding, you know, like I was saying earlier, the life of your average, you know, I'm 35, a 35-year-old Syrian, you know, his life experience, you know, would we as, you know, middle-of-the-road Americans even be qualified to comment on what they should or shouldn't be doing? You know, because so much goes into that area that to get you know, it would require a couple PhDs to scratch the surface of all of it. You know, and then 16 years later,
right?
What do you do with that information?
Right.
You know, is this even our fight if we could understand it?
Well, and that ends up being the problem so often with how we assess how someone is behaving, because they have such a different reality than we have. That, you know, just on our
you know, accepted understanding of human nature, we have to at some point be honest. We're not always honest with ourselves, but I think you have to be honest and look at their experience and acknowledge that they're going to have a different take on things than we have had because we haven't lived in their type of environment. Whether you want to focus on the things that have come from our environment that have affected their environment or their own internal struggles or their own, you know, religious and geopolitical.
Right. You know, are the members of Al-Qaeda really religious extremists or are they, you know, economically disenfranchised? How in the world would you know that unless you've experienced it and or knew someone there personally? You know, my motivations are rarely religious. You know, it's all about food and shelter and, you know, the opposite sex and things like that. That, you know, are the Sunnis and the Shias that much different? Is the suiciding and the killing, is that what it's based on? Or is it, you know, something else? And it's so hard to say because...
Well, that's a good question because, you know, I think about like in America, you can find, I have met many people who have a professed Christian outlook based on the fact that they got help from Christian organizations and you know, I've met several people over the years that were homeless or alcoholic or had some other need,
right,
that was answered by these religious institutions, and so they adopted that institution's religious stance.
Right.
And if you look at some place like Hezbollah or some of those different organizations, that we call them extremist religious organizations, but if you look at actually what they're doing, they are answering some of those social economic needs. They're feeding people. They're providing schools. They're providing, you know, the things that these people need. And then the people then adopt that religious belief. But, you know, I used to have a friend that would complain about, you know, homeless shelters or something that require you to go to some religious service before you can eat. You know, like his complaint was that, you know, if you make me sit down and embrace Jesus before you will feed me, then it's not real. You know, that's not what, you know, you're forcing the conversion before you can get the help. And it's not that stark that you have to accept this, but if it were, that would be understandable. That you know what I mean. That people would adopt worldviews based on those very basic needs being met by someone who says, "This is the worldview you got to take if you want my help."
Yeah, and so, you know, what motivation? You know, what's the motivation for all this? And that's, where it gets so tricky because who knows, you know, without asking. And
we don't ask.
We don't.
We sure don't ask.
We just go, that group is a bunch of terrorists without examining the why they're terrorists or even how it comes down to be described as terrorists or terroristic.
So, and I also think, you know, I alluded to it earlier, that so much of this does, there's a patterning to it. This part of September, not only is 9-1-1-0-1 included, but there are, you know, like the Camp David Accords or, heck, if you want to go all the way back to the astrological defining etymology of the birth of the Savior in this whole conflict. fall, the Jewish New Year, September beginning-ish. The birth of the Messiah, according to Scripture, was September 11th, 3 B.C. You know, up to the... have you ever seen
that? I have not seen that.
Have you, like, Google?
I have often heard that, you know, that we don't... That our dates of Christmas and all that kind of stuff are way off,
right.
But...
All those newfangled star chart programs, the birth, and most people are aware of the Star of Bethlehem. It's not an actual star. It's a congregation of planets in an alignment. If you take all of the astrological information about the birth of the Messiah, put it where it's supposed to be in the sky, and wind one of those charts backwards, it matches up specifically and exactly, because they even have like a moon phase and what house the moon is in, as well as the planets. And it's September 11th, 3 B.C., you know, Sherman's March during the Civil War, the Sherman's March to the Sea started on a Tuesday, September 11th, you know, right on up to the attacks. So there's definitely a reason they trigger a lot of this fear-based, you know, war nonsense on or about this time, and it has, you know, according to them, has to do with solar cycles and astrology and, you know, lots of other bizarre concepts we're never ever taught about. And when you try and teach yourself, you know, it's like a who's who of crazy versus possible. So I see a lot of stuff like this around this time of year, because, you know, and let's think about this. How many times were we supposed to start a war with Iran?
Right.
You know, there's also that factor I don't hear a lot of people talk about, that a lot of this is, you know, the fear-based mind control programming that, you know, September 11th, one of its main components is designed to do, I feel, is to strike that fear in, you know, in many arenas, fear of war, fear of others, fear of attack, fear of abandonment, all the fears you can imagine all roll up into one. You know, that they coordinate a lot of this chicanery to coincide with anniversaries like 9/11, so that, you know, you're extra scared from the get-go because of this time of year. You know, it's Pavlovian in a sense that you can say whatever you want about Assad. If you do it as a right week, you know, just even flipping through like the cable TV guide, you know, and the History Channels and the National Geographics, it's all, you know, 9/11, the day the Pentagon was attacked, you know, heroes on flight. It's so much of the programming is anchored to that day specifically that, you know, one reason they do that is because you forget, you know, rational thinking, and you go into emotion. You know, so many people were emotional for obvious and, you know, justifiable reasons on September 11, 2001, that when you anchor, you know, future events to that day, that emotion takes over and logic leaves. So if you said, you know, anything you wanted about Assad, the terrorists, you know, on anniversaries like September 11th, logical thinking, like I said, flies out the window. And most people can not only verify, most people can't even verify what you're saying, let alone recognize that they're feeling the angst and fear from the original attack.
So it kind of establishes a baseline fear,
right,
that you can. Well, and I kind of see that in what I was talking about earlier with the whole cyber attack stuff. Is like, okay, we've already got this established. Like, we're vulnerable. We've been in this, and that's kind of a
somatic response. Yeah, cyber attack.
Right. It's like a template that we've been using for the last 15 years, right? Because we've been talking about, you know, first it was the 2000 or Y2K. Y2K thing, and then ever since it's been, you know, we've always been on this
the precipice this, of the end.
Yeah, yeah. Like it, you know, it could come from. I'm telling you, it could come from. Somebody could accidentally program a computer or program their calculator, and the next thing you know, yeah. we'll all be
airplanes will fall out of the sky.
Right.
Which is kind of odd that that was one of the, you know, my. My younger version of myself, you know, the Y2K hype before I started analyzing things in a different way, that was one of the things they kept saying over and over and over. It was that, you know, planes could fall out of the sky. Planes could fall out of the sky. You know, the
right.
Y2K bug could make planes fall out of the sky. And then it was a year and 9 months and 11 days later that planes are falling out of the sky and landing on giant buildings and people and, you know, the Pentagon.
And we were ready for it, or not ready for it, but
prepped.
Yeah, we were primed and ready to go down a certain mindset.
They turned up the fear heat in preparation for that day, and they bring us back to it. It's an anchor and trigger. You know, there's lots of psychological terms, but yeah, they love to go back to it around this time of year. You know, and that's the other thing. I don't wonder if people have considered that this, a lot of it may just be pomp and circumstance. Like I said a while ago, it was at least half a dozen times between 2001 and when Ahmad Ahmadinejad left office.
That we were.
Yeah, we were for sure going to war with Iran. You know, ships were en route. You know, there was...
And I remember feeling it.
Yeah, quasi-minor skirmishes with, you know, patrol boats.
Yeah, their boats, yeah, I remember
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was any day now, we're going to war with Iran. And, of course, it never happened. But if they get you scared like it's gonna, you know, the effect is the same.
Hmm. Well, and it reminds me of the old Roosevelt quote, "The only thing you have to fear is fear itself."
Exactly. I mean,
and that seems to be something that we can't grasp, you know, for some reason. I mean,
well, the propaganda machine is, it's a sight to behold. It's hard to blame people for believing it when it's so pretty and in high definition and repeated 8 million times.
Right.
Across the three different varieties of quote unquote mainstream news, that how could all of that be incorrect? You know, it's a brilliant design.
And
know.
Frank Herbert called from Dune, "Fear is the mind killer."
Right.
I mean, that's when you lose the power of your reason.
And that's, yeah, and when you give your power away.
Right.
You know, so many people are willing to, you know, martial law may be begged for at some point. It's not, like, going to be implemented against everybody's will. You know, if enough circumstances lined up properly, you know, there would be people begging for troops in the street.
Well, again, you go back to earlier this year, the Boston bombing, and how readily accepting we were of a shutdown of a major metropolitan city.
Even a lot of people in the quote-unquote alternative media were, you know, well, if it means they're going to catch, you know, this is the time that, you know, martial law is around for reasons, and this would be one of those times when there's an actual imminent threat loose and you don't have time for warrants, there may be another bomb, and you know, you just got to start going door to door to catch them. But if, you know, yeah, if enough of those line up, you know, people will be begging for martial law.
Right.
But we'll see soon enough, I guess. Or not. That's the other thing to consider. They could keep us in this perpetual.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is it almost seems like there's more to be gained by not having, you know, the real thing, or not having
no,
the attack,
yeah.
By keeping you, like you said, in that state
The underwear bomber fear. And the shoe bomber are perfect examples. Those are both labeled bombers, but no bomb ever went off.
Right.
You say, well, I won't attempt either of their names, but the underwear bomber, you know, as funny as his name was, you know, people automatically assume that was an act of terrorism when nothing ever actually even happened.
Right.
And so they can be labeled bombers when
the same thing with Richard Reed, yeah.
Yeah, Richard Reed and the shoe bomber. So, you know, every neck and foot in every airport across the whole entire country for the last 10 years is all out of fear over something that didn't even actually happen. No shoe bomb ever went off. There was never.
And what was
bomb.
Shown, and I remember talking about this at the time, too, is that what's shown is that it doesn't take the government, it doesn't take air marshals, it doesn't take strip searches, it just takes people acting and going, hey, that guy is trying to light his foot.
Right.
That's not happening. Not here, not now. And the people reacted and solved, like actually solved the problem, not like in a 9/11 type sense where it's like, well, we got these guys and the system was quote unquote watching for them and looking and you know, when you start getting into the whole thing about, you know, how they were, some of the 9/11 hijackers were living with informants of the CIA and that kind of stuff, that you start going like, okay, not only are you not capable of protecting us, you're actually part of the problem.
Right. Yeah, they were, you know, and I've termed fear as an acronym, false evidence appearing real. And I think that's a good way to look at it, that the evidence itself doesn't even have to be real. If they can make it look real, you know,
right.
you can be in fear of that. And no scanners are needed. When people see somebody trying to set anything on fire in an airplane, they will instinctively jump on them, air marshal or not, because most people don't want to die in a plane crash, so that's a fairly obvious one. But everybody's taken their shoes off since.
Right.
You know, out of fear of that happening again when the actual, like you said, the actual circumstances of those shoe and underwear bombings took place, you know, people acted immediately, and there was no need for any of it anyway.
Right. Now, we've got about a minute before we go into suicide, and we've actually got two tonight. We've got...
Yeah, there's two on tap. If, you know, 8 million people call during the first one, you know, we can come back up. Basically, there's 9/11 space suicides, and I've been doing those the whole time. There's probably 10 revisions.
Okay.
But, yeah, there's a new... Basically, it's 9/11 before the spin set in, where it's just a big collection of the stuff that went on that day. Explosions, for example, when people say, oh, well, there's, you know, they argue over whether or not there were, you know, bombs placed in the building. And I wasn't there. Nobody was there. The scientists that analyzed the evidence afterwards disagree. But if you go back to the day before the spin set in, it's a collection of every news channel, every eyewitness interview, man on the street, right, left, male, female, it didn't matter. They all 100% said there were secondary explosions. So it's the one of the suicides is a collection of just even mainstream reports before the spin set in. So, you know, 3 years later, 10 years later, 13 years later, if you say anything about explosions, you're literally ridiculed in the mainstream media. But you could do Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Brian Gumbel, all of them, 100% of them, we're all talking about.